Welcome to Managing Myeloma. I'm Dr. Saad Usmani. In today's presentation, I will be discussing individualizing patient care by navigating drug sequencing strategies in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma. Our learning objectives today are describing the appropriate assessments of patient and disease-related factors that impact drug sequencing strategies in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, outline drug sequencing algorithms to guide therapeutic selection in specific patient populations with relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, and also recognize investigational strategies for sequencing drugs in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, including the role of cytogenetics and gene expression. Let us begin. Multiple myeloma clones exist in the same patient. We've previously believed myeloma to be, from an evolutionary standpoint, a static disease where events are happening sequentially. But what we recognize now that the evolution is happening at the same time. There are multiple clones that are proliferating within the same patient. And under duress from therapy over time, different clones will emerge as the dominant clone. So the predominant clone at the time of diagnosis may not necessarily be the one that comes back at the time of relapse. And this was elegantly shown by Jonathan Keats almost 5 years ago, where he had looked at genomic sequencing of myeloma patients with sequential therapy. The point that he made with that paper was that when relapse occur, different clones may have required additional mutations, while the existing clones may not be clinically relevant as the dominant ones. Making the case for combination chemotherapy to control optimally the relapsed myeloma at that time. One also has to recognize that the outcomes of relapsed refractory myeloma patients is poor overall, especially those who become refractory to both proteasome inhibitor bortezomib or immunomodulatory drugs. So about 5 years ago, Dr. Shaji Kumar had published an experience on those patients showing the median overall survival being about 9 months. And what we looked at in a subsequent study is, despite the introduction of pomalidomide and carfilzomib in the armamentarium of relapse refractory myeloma management, the median overall survival of patients was still about 8 months if they are double refractory or have had relapse disease after three or more prior lines of treatment. But it's not simply about the myeloma cell on its own. The myeloma cell is also relying on its bone marrow microenvironment counterparts, its neighbors, for survival and proliferation. And this is where the concept of employing therapies that are not simply just targeting the myeloma cell, but also the tumor microenvironment, the immune repertoire, comes into play. So the bone marrow stromal cells, the T cells, B cells, especially the regulatory T and B cells, MDSCs, play an important role in the survival and proliferation of malignant plasma cells in the bone marrow. So we're now thinking of developing strategies that include those mechanisms of action. So with that, I'm going to present a case and then try to walk through this case and see if we can come up with a good game plan for this particular patient, which is kind of a typical patient that we would see with relatively standard risk features. So 67-year-old woman who originally presented with a mild normocytic anemia and mild renal insufficiency to the primary care physician's office, eventually gets referred to a hematologist when found to have a monoclonal protein, and that workup leads to a revised ISS stage 2 IgG kappa multiple myeloma with translocation 11-14 on the FISH panel. The first line therapy is with RVD for 4 cycles. Patient went on to receive a very good partial response by IMWG criteria. Then the patient went on to receive MEL-200 autologous stem cell transplant, achieving a complete response by the IMWG criteria. This was followed by len maintenance for 3 years with good tolerance. Now the patient is presenting with increasing M spike and declining hemoglobin. The patient remains clinically asymptomatic right now, but the restaging bone marrow biopsy is showing 30% plasma cells, and the FISH is now showing deletion 17p in addition to translocation 11-14. So how would you describe the treatment options for this patient, is the question that one is asking themselves when seeing such a patient. So I'm going to walk through the way that we would be thinking about this patient. So the questions to ask, obviously, what treatment options should I consider for this patient? One very common question is, can I use a lenalidomide-containing regimen for this patient? What lab values and tests are important to track for a response or to monitor side effects? And is there a clinical trial that might be suitable for this patient? So when selecting treatment for a relapsed myeloma patient, we kind of compartmentalize factors that we're considering into patient-related factors, disease-related factors, or treatment-related factors. And from a patient perspective, age, performance status, renal insufficiency, poor marrow reserve, presence or absence of neuropathy, and the degree, and then other comorbidities that the patients have picked up along the way from the time of diagnosis to now. They may not have had cardiac disease at the time they were diagnosed, but they are now developing cardiac issues or pulmonary issues. And then, they may have had diabetes in the past, and now it's getting worse, and they've developed sequelae of diabetes, or they have developed diabetes which was not there at the time of diagnosis. Then from a disease standpoint, their risk status, specifically cytogenetics, deletion 17p, translocation 414, 1416, the rapidity of relapse. So how quickly is the disease relapsing? Does the patient have organ damage, new bone fractures, extramedullary disease, or presence of plasma cell leukemia at the time of relapse, where the patient is going to require quick cytoreduction? Then previous treatments, the kind of depth of response they had, the duration of response, what would be the route of administration, whether patients are going to benefit from combination chemotherapy. Looking at cost of therapy as well as access is going to be important. What kind of toxicities patients may have had with previous treatments will also help you decide whether you can use the same drugs again or not. And then the risk of second primary malignancies is something that is emerging in discussions as we pick and choose treatments for our patients. So we were thinking about all of these factors as we go into our approach or strategy towards a patient, but the overall approach is not regimented. It has to be evidence-based and rational. It has to be personalized for the patient, and we're no longer starting to think of this in, all right, what to use in first relapse or second relapse, but base our decision on several of these host and disease variables as we move along in managing these patients long term. So when do I need to treat this patient? Well, immediate treatment is needed if a patient has a clinical relapse. And when we talk about clinical relapse, this may not be proportionate to the rise in myeloma markers, and that's very important for us to understand. So the M spike may be 0.5 or 0.6, and it's been rising maybe over the last 2 or 3 months, but the patient is starting to have increasing bone pains or new bone lesions, and presenting with hypercalcemia, even though the myeloma markers may not be very high. Then, significant biochemical relapse, so very quick doubling or tripling of myeloma markers over weeks or a few months is going to be a very important landmark where you're seeing a highly proliferative kind of a relapse where myeloma needs to be cytoreduced quickly so the patient can have an improvement in their quality of life and disease burden. Then serum M protein of 10 gram or more, that's a high burden of disease that needs to be controlled fairly quickly. And then There are going to be patients who may not need these criteria, and if you choose to monitor them closely with monthly labs as well as clinic follow-ups, that would be reasonable. But having a low threshold on pulling the trigger on treatment for those patients. Then, can I use the previous regimen again as salvage? When we think about that question, we have to think about the kind of depth of response patient had with that regimen. How rapid was that regimen in reducing or cytoreducing that patient? Whether the patients had a very good partial response or better. And then how long did that response last? So duration of treatment is important. And if depth and duration are reasonable, then you may consider retreatment with the same regimen. You have to know that the kind of mileage you can get out of that regimen is not going to be the same as it was the first time you used it. When we're talking about duration of response, we want to consider at least a 6 months or more of durability of response in the relapse refractory setting. And that marker or that threshold is continually improving, especially in the first relapse setting with some of the newer treatment regimens. And I can highlight them a little later in this presentation. Now, should I be considering a second autologous stem cell transplant? Well, to answer that question, we have to ask, how did the patients do with their first autologous stem cell transplant? Did they tolerate it well? Did they have any life-threatening complications with infections? And how good was their count recovery as well as physical recovery from autologous stem cell transplant in the first case? And in today's day and age, vast majority of patients actually do not have major complications from autologous stem cell transplants. And then did the patients have a good benefit from the PFS perspective? If they did not have any maintenance, we consider at least 18 to 24 months of PFS benefit as a reasonable PFS benefit to start considering a second autologous stem cell transplant. And in light of the maintenance treatment, we're talking about 24 to 36 months of PFS benefit from the first autologous stem cell transplant. If that's the case, then yes, you need to have a discussion about a second autologous stem cell transplant in a younger patient, with the caveat that their PFS benefit is probably not going to be the same duration, but perhaps maybe 50 to 70% of the PFS they got from their first autologous stem cell transplant. Now, let's dive into some of the new data in relapsed myeloma. I'm going to talk about the immunomodulatory-based studies. We've had four trials that have been published in the last 2 years that are influencing the treatment choices we make. So the first study, and in all of these studies, lenalidomide and dexamethasone was used as the control arm. In the first column there, you see the depth of response, VGPR or better, CR or better, response duration, as well as PFS and overall survival hazard ratios that have been mentioned. For the first study, daratumumab was combined with RD, showing a very good partial response of 76% and a complete response or better rate of about 43%. The ASPIRE trial, which combined carfilzomib with RD and compared that to RD, we see a VGPR rate of about 70% and a CR rate of 32%. As we start moving towards the right, the combination of elotuzumab with lenalidomide and dexamethasone appears to give less of a depth of response compared to the other two trials on the left. Exasomib, when combined with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, again, gives a reasonable depth of response. But the key thing that I want to highlight on this particular slide is that the depth of response appears to be correlating with the duration of response that you're getting with these triplet regimens. Perhaps in terms of ease of administration as well as the side effect profile, the regimens on the right side and the right two regimens, the ELO and the IGZA combinations, are perhaps better tolerated and easier to administer compared to KRD or DRD. But then you are compromising on the kind of depth of response you get as well as the durability of response. So each of these would be reasonable options for a patient qualifying for an immunomodulatory-based treatment. What I do want to highlight in each of these studies that our patient that we discussed, the case we discussed, would not have qualified for any of these clinical trials because they were already on lenalidomide maintenance, and those patients were excluded from each of these four studies. So we have to take that as a caveat. In terms of the depth of response, the reason why I want to mention the daratumumab combination, because it's been looked at in more depth from a treatment exposure standpoint, and when it comes to len-naive or len-exposed patients, the median PFS duration as well as depth of response appears to be better in the three-drug combination compared to the two-drug combination, but it's not as good as patients who have been naive to a particular drug like lenalidomide, for example, as you can see in this table. If we start looking at prior lines of treatment as well as looking at one to three prior lines of treatment by way of high-risk cytogenetics, or how quickly the patients were relapsing from their first-line treatment before going on study, we again find that the three-drug combination appears to have a better depth of response and PFS, but it's not the same compared to someone who had normal cytogenetics with the DRD combination. If we start looking now at proteasome inhibitor-based therapy, within that group of patients, we have three phase III trials that I've mentioned here comparing the bortezomib dexamethasone as the control arm to three different combinations. So the CASTOR study looked at the combination of daratumumab with bortezomib dexamethasone. The ENDEAVOR trial looked at carfilzomib dexamethasone compared to bortezomib dexamethasone, and PANORAMA-1 compared the HDAC inhibitor panobinostat, bortezomib dexamethasone, with bortezomib dexamethasone. And for comparative analysis, I did add the phase II data with elotuzumab bortezomib dexamethasone, comparing that to bortezomib dexamethasone in there to give a better assessment of the kind of options one has. It is a randomized phase II trial. Therefore, we have to take that into account. But it does appear that the DVD regimen gives a good depth of response. So does the KD regimen. And each of these regimens were shown to have a better depth of response than the standard of care arm. The median PFS benefit has not been reached in the DVD study for the three-drug combination. It is about 18.7 months with KD. PANOVD did have superior median PFS benefit, but the tolerability was an issue with that regimen. However, this was a positive study. From a clinical practice standpoint, it appears to be a more difficult regimen to give to patients. And the elotuzumab BD, even though there was better depth of response, the median PFS was not as impressive in that phase II study. And I would be highly surprised if we see a phase III trial with that combination coming anytime soon. So With these studies in mind, similar to what we saw with the daratumumab combination with RD, similar analyses were done with DVD, comparing them to VD, showing that the three-drug combination appears to benefit all subgroups, including standard risk and high-risk cytogenetic patients. But perhaps the depth of response and duration of response, is not as good as someone who would be getting the treatment in one prior line of treatment. We have to keep in mind that the high-risk cytogenetics group is a small subset in the study, and even though PFS benefit is about the same, we have to do what we can with the available data, and this slide will become relevant to how we pick treatment for the case that we've discussed. If you start looking at prior treatment exposure, patients who were bortezomib naive appeared to have better depth of response and PFS benefit compared to those who had prior bortezomib exposure. Whereas for those who had been then exposed or refractory, the overall response rate and depth of response appeared to be similar to the group. It's actually better in the DVD arm compared to the VD arm. Looking at the depth of response from a minimal residual disease status, we've had a lot of discussion about MRD as a new depth of response benchmark in studies, and CASTOR and POLLUX trials were the first ones to actually report this in large randomized phase III fashion, demonstrating to us that the three-drug combinations did give better depth of response in terms of MRD negativity at the 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, as well as 10 to the minus 6 thresholds. This would be an important thing to consider, knowing that the patients who had MRD negativity actually did have the best PFS benefit on both the studies. So now we're thinking about these treatment options, and in my mind, for salvage induction treatment options, a proteasome inhibitor-based regimen would be something that I would consider for this patient. So daratumumab, bortezomib, dexamethasone, or carfilzomib, dexamethasone. The depth of response and the side effects that the patients may have had to prior treatments are going to into play. And then second autologous stem cell transplant is also coming into consideration, knowing that our patient had an autologous stem cell transplant, was on maintenance for almost three years. So that would be a consideration for the patient. So our patient did go on daratumumab with VD and achieve a very good partial response after six cycles. The patient then went on to receive a MEL-200 autologous stem cell transplant, achieving a complete response, and then was started on bortezomib maintenance. And I have to qualify the statement that bortezomib is not approved by the FDA for quote-unquote maintenance, but this is the salvage setting, and we are utilizing bortezomib to maintain the patient's response in a salvage relapse setting. In terms of treatment approaches for relapse myeloma, this algorithm kind of walks you through the kind of options one can offer to the patients. So if the patient has the first relapse, we do encourage patients to participate in clinical trial with novel agents. IMiD-based regimens would be considered to someone who did not receive an IMiD in their first-line treatment, or they had a fantastic response and duration of response to the IMiD-based treatment, and then have been off of IMiDs. Or they had prior PI refractoriness or intolerance. So if they're having a fast or aggressive relapse, KRD or DRD would be a good choice for those patients. If it's a slow biochemical relapse, ELO-RD or IXA-RD may be a good option. For PI-based regimens, no prior PI exposure in first-line treatment, or they had PIs in the past with good response and durable PFS, prior IMiD refractoriness or intolerance, or the patients had translocation 414s, those patients tend to do well with proteasome inhibitors. So if they are having a fast or aggressive relapse, daratumumab with VD would be a good option. If they are having a slow biochemical relapse, you may consider a KD as a regimen. And then again, you know, autologous stem cell transplant, we did talk about the threshold we may have for patients who have not received a maintenance treatment or have received maintenance treatment, but that would be something one would consider in early relapse patients. If we start talking about two or more prior lines of treatment, then we are talking about patients who may have had a rapid relapse where they require a quick cytoreduction with a PACE-based or DSAP-based regimen, especially true for patients who have extramedullary disease or secondary plasma cell leukemia. But generally, even if we employ that for a rapid or high-risk aggressive relapse, we then switch those patients over to a carfilzomib or a pomalidomide-based salvage regimen, with PIs being preferred for patients who may have translocation 414. And then we do have daratumumab as an option for patients who are len or bortezomib refractory or have had more than three or prior lines of treatment. A pomalidomide and dexamethasone can be all added now to daratumumab as per the FDA label. And we use DARA-POM-D quite commonly in our practice for patients who are beyond the two or more prior lines of treatment, especially if they haven't seen DARA as part of their first relapse treatment. Autologous stem cell transplants tend to be a very short-term fix, and we use that modality more in patients who may have low marrow reserve, where we're trying to cytoreduce them and give them their autologous stem cells to improve their blood counts. Allogeneic stem cell transplants are used in highly select relapse refractory myeloma patients, but the preference is to do that in a clinical trial like the BMT-CTN 1302 study, which is actively accruing patients. For translocation 11-14 patients, you know, I do want to mention we do have a newer drug or new kid on the block called venetoclax, which is an oral BCL-2 inhibitor approved for CLL and making its way through myeloma treatment. What was very interesting with this particular strategy is the robust response seen in translocation 11-14 patients. Venetoclax as a single agent showed a 40% response rate in translocation 11-14 patients as for the single agent. And for the phase 1 study that looked at the combination of venetoclax with bortezomib dexamethasone, for the translocation 11-14 patients, the overall response rate was 78%. So there appears to be a better depth of response in patients who have translocation 11-14 or cyclin B1 overexpressed myeloma patients. And it's very likely that venetoclax may become our first biomarker-driven treatment modality that becomes approved for myeloma patient, but it's emerging. There are several ongoing precision medicine clinical trials which are including relapse refractory or advanced myeloma patients. I've enlisted the FGFR3 targeted drug JNJ-42756493 with dexamethasone. Then dabrafenib and trametinib are being combined for patients with relapsed refractory myeloma who have BRAF, NRAS, or KRAS mutations. Then we do have ida-sanutlin with ixazomib dexamethasone being examined for deletion 17p patients. The NCI match as well as TAPER trials are looking at several different gene mutations being targeted, and myeloma is included in those studies as one of the eligible diseases. So we'll get to know if we are seeing activity with those single agents for within our myeloma patients. And I'd imagine that we'd use those drugs in combination with the available platforms rather than single agents. But these are very important signal finding studies that we're looking at. The key points to take away from this presentation is to consider patient, disease, and previous treatment-related factors in individualizing treatment for your relapsed refractory myeloma patients. One also has to recognize the prognostic significance of different subtypes of myeloma while choosing treatment. And one way in which I highlighted that is taking a translocation 11-14 patient who did have an addition of deletion 17p at the time of relapse, perhaps signifying that restaging bone marrow biopsies will start becoming important in myeloma. I do this frequently for my patients in clinical practice. The translocation 11-14 patients will have a biomarker-driven option that's coming down the pike. It's already in clinical trials and phase 3 studies, and I'm referring to venetoclax there. So we're going to start seeing more drugs that are more target-driven. And that's why it's important to encourage patients to participate in physician medicine-based clinical trial initiatives like the NCI MATCH or TAPIR, or there are clinical trials that are being developed within the Multiple Myeloma Research Consortium, for example, where you will have patients receiving targeted therapies in addition to platform drugs. Having said that, truly appreciate you joining us. Thank you for viewing this activity.